Good afternoon, members of the court, the audience, counsel. I'm Paul Grant, and I represent Mr. Bowenkamp in this matter. This case, as you know, arose out of an incident in 2005. The trial was in September of 2006, and here we are in September 2012, hearing oral argument. I'd like to start by emphasizing an argument which I made in the briefs, which is that there was insufficient evidence to convict Mr. Bowenkamp. And I'd like to point out to the court for your attention the fact that no one has ever accused Mr. Bowenkamp of having fired the shots that killed Seho Park. No one has ever said that he was the person who was the gunman. It's always been understood that he drove a car. And he was convicted, however, of first-degree murder and of many counts of attempted first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, extreme indifference murder.
As a complicitor?
Yes. Under the theory that he knew about, understood, and intended to aid and contribute to the crime. And the argument I've made, I'd like to repeat, is that the evidence was insufficient even to convict the shooter had the shooter himself been on trial. And as a matter of fact, that shooter has not yet been brought to trial. Prosecutors in this case decided to prosecute the driver and not the shooter. To this date, he has not been prosecuted. But the shooter, who was identified at trial, the shooter himself is probably not guilty of the charges brought here. And the evidence for that, which was presented at trial, was that somewhere on the order of 7 to 10 shots were fired from a moving car by a person with a rifle. And I've been driving by in front of the Velvet Room Bar in Aurora, Colorado. Two of those bullets, it's known where they went, two of the shots. One, tragically, hit Seho Park, and he died within a few hours. The other hit a Volkswagen that was parked in the parking lot not too far away from where the people were standing outside the bar after the bar had closed that evening in September of 2005. That evidence in itself would speak to the fact that whoever was handling that rifle probably didn't have good control of it and may well have been trying to scare people in the crowd and accidentally shot into the crowd because the other seven bullets went elsewhere. Mr. Bowenkamp, in fact, testified at his own trial, and he testified that he didn't realize that the shooter had a gun when they came back to the bar, that he thought the shooter had a bat, a baseball bat, in a bag, in a gym bag, and that the guy was going to create some mayhem with the bat to get even for being beaten up at the bar. The shooter, however, turned out to have a rifle in the bag, which he pulled out in front of the club and shot. Mr. Bowenkamp testified that he was horrified and he was scared and he thought the guy was shooting to scare people. He had no idea that the fellow was shooting towards people.
Well, Mr. Grant, isn't that what extreme indifference murder is all about? If you're going to spray bullets somewhere and they actually hit someone, aren't you guilty of extreme indifference murder?
No, Judge.
Why not?
If you are to be found guilty of extreme indifference murder, you have to be firing into an area where you know people to be occupying that area or likely to be occupying that area without any concern for human life. In other words, you're willing to fire into a room full of people, not caring whether you kill somebody or not, or into a crowd of people, not caring whether you shoot somebody or not. However, if you fire into the air where there's no likelihood that anybody's going to be hit by that bullet to scare someone,
bullets fall, don't they?
No, not with a killing force. An accidental killing force, perhaps. You can shoot into the ground. A bullet could ricochet off the ground and bounce up and hit somebody. That isn't the same. That isn't either.
Mr. Grant, it seems like all you're arguing is particular inferences that the jury might have drawn from the evidence, but the jury might have drawn very different inferences. They might have drawn the inference that your client knew what was in the bag, that he knew that the passenger intended to shoot people, and that he aided in doing that.
They may well have drawn that inference, but the evidence wasn't sufficient to support the inference. There was no substantial evidence to support that inference. And I'll point out a couple of facts. Every witness who testified at that trial, who saw the fight at the Velvet Room that occurred before the bar closed, said that Mr. Bowenkamp was a peacemaker. Mr. Bowenkamp pulled people apart at the fight. Mr. Bowenkamp wasn't upset. He wasn't angry. Even when somebody sucker punched him, he didn't get angry. He was a peacemaker. This was said by half a dozen witnesses at trial.
And yet, by his own admission, according to your explanation of his testimony, he was willing to drive his friend back to the bar so that he could beat up somebody with a baseball bat.
Yes, or break up the front of the bar or whatever he wanted to do about that. Stupid thing, a foolish thing, contributing to an assault.
Not exactly a peacemaker.
He was a peacemaker during the fight.
Mr. Grant, as I understand the record, the shooting occurred after the defendant and his friend Mills had lost a fight at the bar.
No, that record, that is incorrect. And one witness said that. The attorney general has said that. The prosecutor said that, but not one witness did.
And what's wrong with the statement?
The statement is that Mr. Donnicam didn't lose a fight. He wasn't in a fight. He wasn't fighting. He wasn't hitting. He was breaking people up. To say that he was involved in a fight is the kind of argument that misleads the jury and misrepresents the facts.
Was his friend involved in a fight?
The shooter was involved in a fight, whether
okay.
they're friends or not.
All
is
right.
a different
So point. That would correct the statement. And then he drove the shooter past the bar twice. First, without any shots being fired. Second, with Mills shooting.
That's what the evidence showed.
Okay. And prior to the shooting, the defendant spoke to his friend. Do I pronounce it correctly if I say Suh or Sue?
Suh. That's how I would pronounce it. I don't speak Korean.
While in the parking lot with Mr. Mills and instructed Mr. Suh to stay inside the bar.
Yes.
And when Mills retrieved the firearm and retrieved it from the bag, the car was not yet in front of the bar.
It's not clear exactly where the car was and whether in front of means directly, immediately in front of, or 100 yards away. I don't think the evidence is that clear where he pulled the gun out, but he pulled it out of the parking lot.
And defendant's girlfriend testified that defendant said something to her about his participation in a shooting, a drive-by shooting.
And he had. He had driven the car from which a gun was fired.
On the strength of those facts, you don't think the jury could draw an inference that your client was an aider and a abettor?
And had
knowledge?
No, I think they could suspect that. I think that they could think it's a possibility, but I don't think that there's substantial evidence upon which a reasonable jury could conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Bonenkamp knew what was on the mind of the person who had the gun and used the gun. But I'd like to move on to two other arguments today, not having a lot of time, and I would like to reserve 4 minutes. The record, as the court knows in this case, is incomplete. Now, the record being incomplete after 5 years is unacceptable in a case of this seriousness, and that's now 6 years later. The record has never been corrected, it's never been completed, and it can apparently never be completed.
Mr. Grant, we, this court, not this division, this court remanded this case to the trial court for settling the record under Car 10.
That's correct.
That record was settled under Car 10 and certified by the trial court.
It's not complete, and it's not. And
that's your argument today, but we're not in the business of settling records.
Show me in the briefs where the record transmitted to this court is not what Judge White ordered to be transmitted to this court. You do not yet have a transcript of a videotaped deposition taken in March of 2006.
Assume for a moment that the entirety of the DVD was played for the jury. How are you prejudiced by that?
Okay, you can't make that assumption, and that's not a fair argument, because it's an artificial argument. I'll tell you why. The complete DVD was not played, so you have to assume that parts, you have to understand that parts were played and parts were not played. So you can't assume that the entire thing could have been played or was played, because you know it wasn't. We all know that it wasn't.
That's fine, but
you don't know.
In determining whether there's anything wrong with what was played for the jury, can't we just look at what is on the DVD and see if there's anything wrong with that and if any of that evidence was given to the jury, whether there's a problem with it?
No, you cannot, because you don't know what the judge's rulings were. You don't know what was in and what was out. You don't know whether character...
How about if we assume that was all in it? Why is that a problem?
All in.
I know, but what's the problem with assuming...
Because it could have turned out that what was allowed in prejudiced because of what was kept out. If that had been all in, it may have been a more balanced presentation. But what was kept out may well have biased and prejudiced, but the fact is that I can't argue to you what was kept out. I can't argue to you what the judge's rulings were, and neither can the prosecution, because there's no record. And I'll point out to you that Judge White himself said that the rulings he made on the evidence, he doesn't know if the jury ever even heard his rulings. So we don't know if the jury was hopelessly confused or unfairly biased by virtue of reviewing the record, because the record doesn't say. And that transcript is still not here of the videotape of the entirety, which is not in the record, let alone a video, a transcript of what was played for the jury.
I think that's incorrect. I think we do have videotapes of the entirety of the deposition.
You do. You do not have a transcript of the entirety of the deposition taken in March of 2006. You have a videotape. You don't have a transcript.
And we have reviewed the videotapes.
That may well be. But you don't have, you don't know what the jury heard, and you don't know whether the rulings of the court were communicated to the judge or they were not communicated to the judge. You also have another argument, and I'm going to take some of my time right now. You also have another argument which demands a reversal, and that is that the prosecutor made improper argument in closing argument, referring to facts which were not evidence, in order to impeach the credibility of Mr. Bonecamp. She referred to phone calls and said, isn't it convenient that the defendant can't remember phone calls today? Ladies and gentlemen, she argued, that shows you that he is lying to protect himself. That's not exactly the word she used, but that's the argument she used to attack and destroy the credibility of Mr. Bonecamp. She did it in closing argument, referring to phone calls which were not in evidence, which she knew would not be allowed in evidence because she didn't have anyone there to authenticate and present those so-called phone calls. We objected when she was asking the questions that it was unfair impeachment. We objected when she made the closing argument. She said basically, don't trust this man because he now has a convenient lapse of memory. That's her evidence, that his memory is unreliable in order to protect himself. That's her evidence to attack his credibility. The trial judge ruled, Judge White ruled, counsel, that's overturned. This is just argument of counsel. Well, that's not sufficient. You can't say that counsel can argue whatever they want to about the evidence when counsel misrepresents the evidence to the jury and asks them to draw inferences from what is not evidence, negative inferences against the credibility of Mr. Bonecamp. Then you have an unfair trial and you have a violation of his rights.
Mr. Grant, there was independent evidence of a phone call to his girlfriend, correct?
No.
No evidence of a phone call to his girlfriend. That's your position on the record.
And what I'm talking about is the so-called evidence that he called the shooter, that he called some of his friends from this fight, the evidence which the prosecutor argued showed that he planned to come back here and fight these people. This whole crew came back to do this.
What about evidence of the call to Mr. Suh? Anything about that?
That's before the incident.
Okay. But he claimed not to remember.
Okay. No, he didn't. He claimed not to remember calling Mr. Suh.
His girlfriend?
I don't know about this call to his girlfriend. But a call to the girlfriend is not evidence of guilt. But she made the argument. The prosecutor made the argument. She impeached him. If you look at the record, with supposed phone calls, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 calls that evening, and she says, isn't it convenient he doesn't remember those phone calls? That's improper. Those phone calls are not in evidence. There's no way around that. The record here is inadequate. There are parts of the transcript that are still not here. There are court reporters, Ms. Ava Chavez, not here. If you'll notice the opening brief, I had to quote from things which are not here yet, and which Jeff White certified as part of the record, in which you do not have. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jillian Price, registration number 40815, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. The record in this case is not perfect, but neither is it as hopelessly confusing as Mr. Grant has argued it to be. Indeed, the record contains ample evidence by which this court can discern the defendant's arguments, and each of those arguments fail. As an initial note with respect to the record, it clearly centers around the video deposition of Mr. Suh as it was played for the jury. In the record before this court, there is a full DVD recording of that video, and at volume 10, there is a transcript of that deposition. Now, it's true that is not a blow-by-blow transcript of what the jury heard at the time. However, in volumes 11 and 12, the court reporter's transcriptions of the party's objections, and the trial court's rulings are present. A review of these documents shows that the record is complete, certainly complete enough for this court to review this case.
How do you respond, Ms. Price, to your learned proponent's argument that we can't tell exactly whether there was prejudice from what came in versus what didn't come in on the DVD?
Well, dovetailing on what Your Honor asked my learned opponent, let's assume that everything did come in on that DVD. The issue is the prosecutor's question to Mr. Suh concerning Mr. Suh's, whether or not Mr. Suh was aware that Mr. Bonenkamp had a prior conviction for felony menacing. Now, that question was prompted by the defense opening the door to Mr. Bonenkamp's law-abiding character. As such, that was proper impeachment. Even if the jury did hear it, it was a proper question for the prosecution to have asked.
Well, now, how do we know if the question that prompted the response was actually played for the jury as well?
Sure, and that's a fair point, and we don't know that for certain. However, there were a number of other witnesses at the trial, including Mr. Bonenkamp's father and other friends, who repeatedly said, he is a good guy, he's got a good character, I can't imagine him being involved in any kind of behavior like this. So I think there was still plenty of counterbalancing evidence on the record to combat the prosecution's question, are you aware that he has this felony menacing conviction?
And as I understand the briefs, part of the claimed prejudice is that there may have been portions of the tape that weren't played for the jury that were positive reflections upon Mr. Bonenkamp's character.
Sure, and those were Mr. Suh's statements. I don't remember his words verbatim, but Mr. Suh says, yes, I believe Mr. Bonenkamp has a law-abiding character. I do not believe Mr. Suh has a character for violence. I've known him for a long time. I think he's a good guy. And again, that is what prompted the prosecution's question. But again, even if that portion of Mr. Suh's deposition was not played, a number of other witnesses did testify that Mr. Bonenkamp, in their opinion, had a good character. Additionally, Mr. Bonenkamp testified himself and introduced the fact that he did have a prior conviction for felony menacing. Now, to the extent that defendant argues that the name and nature of that conviction, again, felony menacing with a deadly weapon, was somehow prejudicial, the prosecution is allowed to name the charge and the circumstances of that conviction. There was no inference that that conviction must have been something involving a gun. Indeed, the fact was that Mr. Bonenkamp threatened somebody with his fists, and as this court is well aware, a fist can indeed be a deadly weapon. Under those circumstances, the fact that the record is not perfect does not prevent this court from reviewing the case, nor does it evidence prejudice, let alone prejudice requiring reversal for Mr. Bonenkamp. With respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, the standard by which this court reviews is looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution and determining if those facts in that light are sufficient that a reasonable juror could reasonably find that the defendant committed the crime. In this case, by Mr. Bonenkamp's own testimony, we know that whether he was a peacemaker or not, he was involved in this fight. His best friend, well, perhaps I shouldn't say best friend, but his friends were being beaten up in this fight. Mr. Bonenkamp himself was sucker punched. After this fight, he drove Mr. Mills back to Mr. Mills' house so that Mr. Mills could get baseball bats and a gun. Mr. Bonenkamp then drove Mr. Mills back to the bar, and Mr. Mills told Mr. Bonenkamp, I'd like to use this gun to scare the people that I just fought with. Mr. Bonenkamp continued to drive his car past the bar. Mr. Mills shot that gun into the crowd of people. This shows a universal malice and an extreme indifference towards human life, and this is sufficient to support Mr. Bonenkamp's conviction as a complicitor. With respect to the,
I believe that Mr. Grant indicated that it's only extreme indifference if there's a crowd milling about into which shots are fired. Was there evidence that that was what the case was here?
Oh yes, there was definitely a crowd of people milling outside the Velvet Room bar. There were, let's see, there was the victim. There were, my recollection of the record is that there were at least 10 individuals standing outside the Velvet Room when Mr. Bonenkamp drove Mr. Mills by the bar. And whether he shot up, down, sideways, he shot that gun and sprayed bullets into the crowd of people that killed the victim. That is indeed extreme indifference towards human life. With respect to the telephone calls and the prosecutor's comment in closing argument that Mr. Bonenkamp had, quote, a striking loss of memory, this did not constitute facts not in evidence, nor did it constitute improper argument. While the prosecution was cross-examining Mr. Bonenkamp, she asked him if he recalled making a number of telephone calls. She had, as her good faith basis for asking those questions, an uncertified copy of what she alleged to be Mr. Bonenkamp's cell phone records from the night of the murder. She did not admit that document into evidence, and indeed she specifically told the court during the bench conference she did not seek to introduce that document as evidence. That was simply the good faith basis that she used during her cross-examination. And what that cross-examination elicited from Mr. Bonenkamp was that he did not remember making, by my count of the record, about 22 calls on the night of the murder. And then in closing argument, she says, Mr. Bonenkamp has had a striking loss of memory. He doesn't remember making these calls. On a night that certainly was one of the most impactful in Mr. Bonenkamp's life, he does not recall these phone calls.
Well, I think the problem, though, is that while there's certainly evidence that he didn't recall making phone calls, what was the evidence that he actually made the phone calls? Well, because to argue that he has a striking lack of memory assumes that the phone calls were made.
Well, Mr. Bonenkamp simply said, I don't remember. And there was no evidence admitted at trial that said, yes, he did make these phone calls. I'm going to impeach Mr. Bonenkamp with this document that says, yes, he did make the phone call. There was no evidence of that nature. The prosecutor was simply reiterating Mr. Bonenkamp's testimony that he does not recall. I think a striking loss of memory, that phrase, is a valid thing to say, and that's proper rhetorical device for a prosecutor to use when describing the defendant's testimony.
It's only a loss of memory if the calls actually happened. If they didn't happen, there's no loss of memory.
Well, the record shows Michelle Kim, who was Mr. Bonenkamp's girlfriend, testified that she did receive a phone call from Mr. Bonenkamp. We also know that Mr. Bonenkamp called Mr. Suh.
Did he, though, specifically say in his testimony that he didn't recall making those calls?
I believe he recalled making the telephone call to Mr. Suh. I believe there were several telephone calls to Ms. Kim that he said that he did not remember. There were also phone calls to Ms. Kim that were made the next day that I believe he did remember making. But I'm talking about specifically these calls that happened, on that night of the murder, not the ones that were made subsequent. Under these circumstances, the prosecutor's closing argument was proper. And also, as a note, Mr. Grant mentioned that the prosecutor's argument was that Mr. Bonenkamp was lying about these phone calls. That is absolutely not the case, and that is not what the record reflects. What the record shows, okay, the prosecutor's statement was, defendant had a striking loss of memory in the courtroom this morning. He seems unable to remember these phone calls. This is a day that had been the most impactful day of Mr. Bonenkamp's life, and yet that he has no reflection of those phone calls or discussions with other people. And she simply asked the jury to remember that portion of the testimony when determining Mr. Bonenkamp's credibility. When a witness testifies, including a defendant, the prosecutor is allowed to highlight testimony that impacts on that on that witness's credibility.
Judge White ruled that that was an inappropriate statement.
I'm sorry?
And Judge White ruled that that was an inappropriate statement.
Judge White ruled that the prosecutor's comment was simply the arguments of counsel during the closing argument. The other point that I'll note is there was this was not a repeated comment throughout the closing argument. There was one mention in the prosecutor's initial close, and there was one mention in the rebuttal close. And those are at volume 9, pages 215 and pages 258. Those are the only two references to this portion of that testimony. Unless this court has any further questions, I will rest on the briefs and request that this court affirm Mr. Bonenkamp's convictions. Thank you.
Grant?
The record does not include a transcript of the videotape deposition, despite what you've just been told. It's not in volumes 10, volume 11, or volume 12. You see something marked as an exhibit from the prosecutor from the trial. It is not the court reporter's transcript of the videotape deposition. Concerning Judge White's ruling, he ruled that he overruled the objection to the questions about the, to the closing argument about the failure to recall the videos or the phone calls. Dave Sells' testimony was very important. His character evidence is very important. As the judges here have asked me, didn't Mr. Sells get a warning from Mr. Bonnenkamp? Well, it would be important for the jury to understand that he would never in his imagination have believed that this was a warning to something, some murderous violence was about to occur, because he didn't believe that Mr. Bonnenkamp had that character. If that testimony wasn't allowed to be presented to the jury, it's extremely harmful that Mr. Sells' testimony that he got a warning may have been used to convict Mr. Bonnenkamp, but his testimony that Mr. Bonnenkamp didn't have the character to be involved in murderous violence was kept out. That would be incredibly prejudicial. We don't know, and Judge White doesn't know. And there's, my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Thank you again, Ms. Price. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.